Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 4th of November. The final day of campaigning for Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, Jaime Kumarasamy is following all the latest developments in the swing state of Wisconsin in an election which is still too close to call. Also, students in England will pay higher tuition fees from next year. Will that make any significant difference to the financing of universities? And a biopic with a difference. We hear from the director of Piece by Piece, a film which tells the story of the musical career of Pharrell Williams in Lego.
You're listening to The World Tonight with Julian Warwicker in London and me, James Kumarasamy, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There is one more sleep to presidential election day here in the United States, and the opinion polls are still suggesting the race between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Kamala Harris is coming down to a small number of votes in seven or so states where the outcome is unclear. We are in the biggest city in one of those states, Wisconsin, in the Midwest, where recent presidential elections have been decided by fractions of 1%. I'm in Solly's Grill, a popular diner in the north of Milwaukee, which celebrates Wisconsin's love of dairy products with its signature dish, the Butter Burger. Just soak in that concept. We'll hear from the diner before the end of the programme. First, though, let's hear from the presidential candidates. They have both been in this city in recent days, although today they have sent their running mates to Wisconsin and are instead concentrating their efforts in one of the other swing states, the one with the greatest electoral weight, Pennsylvania, concentrating those efforts exclusively there in the case of Kamala Harris. In the last hour, she struck a confident tone when addressing supporters in the city of Allentown.
So, Allentown, this is it. Just one more day. One more day. One more day left in one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime, and momentum is on our side. Momentum is on our side. Can you feel it? We have momentum, right?
In Reading, Pennsylvania tonight, Donald Trump, who campaigns in front of a sign that reads, "Trump will fix it," told the crowd that they were the ones who could help him chisel out a victory.
You built this country, I have to tell you. You built this country. You're going to save this country, too. You're going to save it. Because, you know, if we win Pennsylvania, not me, if we win Pennsylvania, we win the whole ball of wax. It's over. It's over.
Well, just before we came on air, I spoke to the BBC's Tom Bateman. He's also in Pennsylvania. He's in the city of Philadelphia ahead of Kamala Harris's final campaign event there.
Well, where I am now, and you might be able to hear some of the noise as the stage is being set here, is the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Now, this is a very famous location outdoors because it is a very, very large and imposing, impressive building with stone steps that go all the way up to the colonnade here and a big sign saying "A President for All." The most famous thing that these steps are known for are from the movie Rocky, in which Rocky Balboa finishes his flourish training up as he's about to have his fight with the world heavyweight champion. And he's, you know, this is a very symbolic place. Tourists come here because of that, and it has become a symbol of the underdog taking on a champion, which is of course just how Kamala Harris has tried to present herself throughout this campaign. I can see the bulletproof glass around the podium now, and the Secret Service agents are getting everything ready here. It's going to be a star-studded finale for the Harris campaign, with Oprah Winfrey and Lady Gaga among other stars here. They want to focus on the positives, and we are told by the campaign they won't be mentioning Donald Trump at all. So that'll be her final pitch. Meanwhile, Donald Trump will be in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That is where he has finished his last two presidential campaigns, of course, one successfully, one unsuccessfully. And I think what we've seen in his rallies, and I was at one yesterday here in Pennsylvania over the last few days, is an attempt to rally his base. I think whereas Kamala Harris is trying to get the few remaining undecideds towards her, the real attempt for Donald Trump is to try to get voters out, particularly those who might not ordinarily vote. That's where they believe their biggest potential lies. So I think we'll hear many more of his campaign messages once again in that final pitch from him in Michigan.
That was the BBC's Tom Bateman in Philadelphia. Well, let's see how supporters of the two candidates are feeling on this last night of the campaign. A little earlier, I caught up with Mick Mulvaney. He's one of the people who served as Donald Trump's chief of staff when he was in the White House, although he was in a different role when he resigned from the Trump administration after the attack by Trump supporters on the US Capitol building on January the 6th, 2021. I asked Mick Mulvaney whether he is one of the 78 million or so Americans who have already voted early, and if so, whether he cared to share who he'd voted for.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, no, I voted yesterday in my home state of South Carolina for Donald Trump. I think I voted straight Republican ticket, although there's some Democrats locally who I know personally.
Can Donald Trump win, do you think?
Sure, I think he can win. He could lose. In theory, I suppose they could tie as well. It seems as if both campaigns are sort of stumbling to the finish line. The Harris closing argument about Trump being a fascist, I don't think is getting much traction. And Trump continues to sort of wander all over the place as opposed to beat the issue of how people are, you know, were better off when he was president. So they're both almost looks like they're trying to give it away, but someone is going to win on Tuesday, I would expect.
Well, the other thing Donald Trump has been saying, and we've heard this before, is this is going to be a stolen election. Does that worry you?
You know, without the data point of 2020, it wouldn't bother me. It would be, I'd see it as hyperbole and just sort of him talking. But with a data point of 2020, yeah, I'm a little concerned about it. There have been, I have no difficulty with lawsuits surrounding our elections. I think they're healthy. In fact, if anything, they help increase the credibility of the election outcomes when people have a chance to bring what they consider to be evidence to the courts and say, look, this is what happened, et cetera, et cetera. I don't like the idea of anyone who loses not losing gracefully. I know there's been a lot of attention on what happens if Trump loses. I think there should be some attention on what happens if Harris loses as well. But either way, I hope that once we have a clear winner, that the loser will concede gracefully.
That rhetoric, it's not disqualifying for you. I mean, that on top of the very violent language that he uses on the stump. And I know, and I've spoken to Republicans who say, look, there's stuff going on both sides, but he is empirically unique in using the language of shooting, of bloodshed, of the fake media, perhaps taking a shot in front of him. Is that not disqualifying?
Yeah, no, it's not, because it's not right. And look, I've been critical of the man's style from the very beginning. Again, when you're the chief of staff, you have to be critical of the boss. You're the one person who gets paid to be critical of the president of the United States. But the comments you mentioned that, you know, referring to the headlines here were that he said that Liz Cheney should go before a firing squad. That's false. The comments.
Well, hold on a second. Sorry. I just referred to the language. I didn't give you the quote.
Yeah,
you would not quibble with the fact he has talked about bloodshed, about shooting,
yeah,
you know,
and the blood,
even
well,
if the words have been distorted.
Take mm-hmm. bloodshed for an example. I mean, there's going to be bloodshed in the automotive industry. Is that disqualifying language for a president of the United States? I don't think so. Look, again, the man's style I know rubs a lot of people the wrong way, including me some of the time. But I think he's become a caricature of himself by the misrepresentation of some of his statements in the media. So you ask him if it's disqualifying. It's like, no, his language is not disqualifying.
And let's just posit the possibility, the real possibility, he is elected. Are you worried about who might be around him in a second administration?
Generally,
no. Traditional Republicans?
Yeah. To the positions that you'd recognize and folks overseas recognize and most Americans would recognize, the big names, the cabinet secretaries, all the names I've seen on all of the lists, and I've seen several, are top quality people. Senators, former cabinet secretaries, leaders of business and industry and so forth. A traditional sort of pool from which to grab a cabinet. That being said, some of the non-highlighted positions, some of the senior advisors to the president, some of the inside positions do worry me. Peter Navarro is likely to have a place in the new administration. He worries me. I don't think he's stable.
He's the economic advisor.
He was a trade advisor, supposedly. Now, I don't know. He was also apparently at the end of the term a leading advisor on election fraud. How he knows anything about that, I have no idea.
But he's just come out of prison, hasn't he?
Just come out of prison. Steve Bannon's just come out of prison. So you ask a question, am I frightened? Not as much in the way that other people might think. But since I know how the White House works, yes, I am concerned about various individuals that might end up in a second term and some of the more quiet positions.
And that was Mick Mulvaney, who served as chief of staff in the White House to Donald Trump and who has just voted for him. But let's look at one of the issues that is pretty much near the top of the opinion polls when people are asked here what is on their minds going into this election. Top is the economy, but one of the other big ones is immigration. Now, last month, The World Tonight's James Menendez reported on how that has been playing out along the US-Mexico border. But it's also had an impact here in Wisconsin, 1,500 miles away. Over the past few years, nearly 1,000 undocumented migrants, mostly from Nicaragua and Venezuela, have arrived in Whitewater. It's a small college town about an hour's drive from here. Some people have raised the alarm about pressure on local schools, while the police chief wrote a letter to the White House asking for more resources. And that caught the eye of Donald Trump, who name-checked the town on the campaign trail.
Look no further than the small town of Whitewater, Wisconsin. Does anybody know Whitewater? After being inundated with Biden migrants, this tiny town now has a budget shortfall of over $400,000. Their public schools are straining with hundreds of new migrant students who don't speak a word of English. Their police force is being diverted from traffic stops to migrant crime, our favorite new term, migrant crime. It's a new category of crime. And their town is becoming a hotbed of cartel activity and illicit drugs like nobody's ever even envisioned before.
Well, I've been to Whitewater to see the impact of immigration on one small town that's become caught up in the national debate. At the homecoming parade in Whitewater, the local university's marching band, dressed in swing state purple, sashays down Main Street, followed by feathered mascot Willie Warhawk in the back of an open-top car. Among those watching this traditional celebration of the local football team, Councillor Brienne Brown. She's running for the Wisconsin State Assembly as a Democrat this year, but it was during a previous election campaign that she noticed how the town was changing.
During the pandemic, I was knocking on doors, and a lot of the housing that usually housed students, people speaking Spanish were answering the doors. There's one guy from Venezuela and another few guys from Nicaragua, so we probably got 50 people here during the pandemic. But as chain migration happens, you get a good job and you have a roof over your head, you're going to send the word home, hey, this is a good place to live. So little by little, more people started showing up, and that's when the police started noticing right around 2021 was because it was a very, very cold day and they found a family living in a barn. And that's when they realized something was going on because they'd also started pulling over more immigrants who were in their cars, but they didn't have driver's licenses. So that's when they started realizing they did not have the resources to deal with some really minor infractions. And that's when it got really frustrating because instead of it being elected officials helping us with resources, it was elected officials turning it into a circus and wanting to discuss with the news how terrible Whitewater was.
People here feel about becoming this totemic town?
We're pretty angry about it. The majority of people here are very stoic and kind and would like to just make things work. And to have people throwing bombs at us, I mean, for instance, the first time this happened, neo-Nazis from Illinois came up to our university campus and put Nazi signs all over our campus. And they said on their Facebook page they did it because of the immigrants. Like, they are actually making us a target for people who don't even live here.
Good morning. My name is Henry Kinson. I grew up in Whitewater.
Henry is a local businessman and former school board member who gave evidence to the Republican-chaired House Judiciary Committee.
I was asked to come here to testify as to the educational situation in my hometown of Whitewater due to the large recent influx of non-English speakers.
At the Sweet Spot Cafe in that hometown, he told me what concerned him most.
There's a marked decline in educational outcomes, which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, if you have to spend more time translating to kids, you're going to have less favorable outcomes. The facts don't lie. This has nothing to do with race. It has to do with the fact that teachers have to deal with kids who don't speak English in the classroom with a bunch of kids who also do speak English. I have several friends who are teachers. It's a challenging situation. That's not a racial issue. It's an English issue.
And what impact has President Trump talking about this town had, do you think?
I think it's brought a focus on things that otherwise the city leaders didn't want. So I'm happy that Trump mentioned Whitewater because it forces Whitewater to admit that there are issues from the large number of immigrants, and then we can talk about how to deal with it instead of pretending that everything is great and the only people who have a problem with it are closet racists.
Do you think if President Trump is elected, then he will make a difference?
Well, he can't do worse. He can stop the influx. And at this point, I'd be happy for the bleeding to stop.
I've just entered the community space here in Whitewater. Just in front of me, there's a mountain of bagels being built on a table, all donations from a local store. A bright mural greets you. It says, "All are welcome here," in English and in Spanish. It's a place where members of the community, immigrants and others, can come and get free food, free household goods, free clothes, all of it donated. And there's also a classroom where English classes take place, and you can come here and get advice on immigration law.
I just had a woman come in with two bags of handmade mittens. She lives an hour away and brought us these mittens. What a godsend.
Kay Robers is the co-founder of the community space. She tells me that Donald Trump's comments about Whitewater have actually been helpful.
It's been wonderful because people are realizing that we're taking care of people and they want to be part of it. People are very generous with their donations.
This is the warehouse space at the back. Lots of people are bringing in donations, sorting them out. Among them is Pedro. He's been in the country for more than 3 decades. He helps out with the sorting, but also with the translation.
Today I helped one family. They was about a week here in the United States. They're looking for clothes for winter.
But as well as helping the new arrivals, Pedro says he's suffered because of their presence.
They see my color and my skin, and they stop me. The cap, they saw me.
He tells me he's been caught up in the police search for migrants driving without licenses. And for this Mexican-American, illegal immigration will be a key consideration when he votes.
Because we're working so hard and we pay taxes to help those people living in the hotels in Chicago, New York, not pay any penny. And we're working hard. They come from different country. I'm Mexico, but I think it's not right.
So you're a legal immigrant to this country and you are worried about people who are coming here illegally?
Yes. And Trump say they can stop that.
So you're leaning towards Trump?
A little bit.
But you will decide on the day? On Tuesday?
I wait till last minute.
As Whitewater comes together to celebrate its local football team, it's clear that the town is still grappling with the challenge of immigration, an issue that has thrust it into the national spotlight and could determine the outcome of Tuesday's election.
The view from Whitewater. Well, let's speak now to Ambassador Wendy Sherman, US Deputy Secretary of State under Joe Biden from 21 to 23, a backer of Kamala Harris. Welcome to the programme, Ambassador. Look, your candidate, she started well, didn't she? She had lots of joy, lots of positivity. The polls seemed to like that. Then she went on the attack against Donald Trump, and it stalled rather, didn't it? Did the strategy work?
Well, we'll find out whether the strategy worked, but I'm quite hopeful. Vice President Harris has led a campaign, not a campaign that is positive, that believes that we can bring all of America together. But she's also campaigned with very specific issues to make sure that people can afford housing, can afford their groceries, that small business is supported, that we build our jobs going into the future. And also she's voted to make sure that women can have reproductive freedom. It's a big issue here. Some of us are even saying it's Rovember.
Well, a lot of women we've spoken to in this state of Wisconsin have certainly put it high on their priorities. I just wonder, though, about the short time she's had, really, to define her campaign. I think it's the shortest election campaign in modern history, isn't it? If your old boss, Joe Biden, had stood down earlier, wouldn't she be in a much better position on this last night of the campaign?
Well, you know, when campaigns are short, as you know, in the U.K., there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is it doesn't last forever. Our campaigns tend to last forever. The bad news is that she's had to do many things simultaneously. She's had to disqualify Trump, which in my view is not a hard thing to do. She has had to introduce herself to voters, and she's had to tell voters what her vision is for the future. I think every analyst has said she has run an absolutely brilliant campaign. extraordinary, really incredibly well organized with a great ground game. And I must say, as someone who cares about our national security, virtually every national security person associated with the first Trump administration does not support the president and believes he is a danger to our country and to your security as well.
Well, let me just talk about one foreign policy issue that has loomed large in this campaign, and it could have an impact in one of the other swing states of Michigan. It's entirely possible, because of the large Arab-American population there, that the administration's policy on Gaza, which many of them are very unhappy about, could actually lose that state and possibly the election for the Democrats. Could and should Kamala Harris have done more to distance herself, perhaps, from that policy?
Well, I think she's done quite a bit. She, in her remarks yesterday when she was in Michigan, she spoke directly to this. She said she was going to do everything she could to get this war over, to make sure there was a political horizon for Palestinians, while, of course, supporting our ally Israel to defend itself. She's been quite outspoken about the need for humanitarian assistance. And I must say, I would remind our voters that Donald Trump has said that he wants to deport all Muslims. So this is not a situation where people should trust Donald Trump.
Briefly, for you, what's at stake in this election?
For me, the stake in this election is the future of our democracy and the future of freedom for all Americans of all types. We have had great divisions over the years, and division creates an opening for adversaries. So bringing our country together in a unified way, which the vice president has tried to push very hard, particularly in this closing message, makes us a stronger country. She will invest in America, but work with our partners and allies abroad. Mm-hmm.
Ambassador Wendy Sherman, Kamala Harris supporter, thanks very much.
James, thank you. You have to go back more than 7 years for the last time there was a rise in tuition fees for students in England. But next year there will be an increase to £9,535, as the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, confirmed in the Commons this afternoon. It's been less than 30 years since fees were introduced. That was in 1998, when they were set at £1,000. They were tripled to £3,000 in 2006, then again to £9,000 in 2012, a decision that you'll remember did significant political damage to the Liberal Democrat half of the then coalition government. In 2017, they went up to £9,250 the last time there was a rise. Well, Alex Stanley is the NUS Vice President for Higher Education. So what's his reaction to today's announcement?
It's one of frustration, to be honest. And look, we are realistic. We know that higher education is in a state of crisis right now. But the answer to that crisis cannot be to further burden the debt on our students. Because if we go back to 1998, when tuition fees were first introduced, they were done so under the understanding that there'd be a real balance between public and private funding. And currently that public funding sits at just 16%.
But you'd acknowledge that these fees have not shifted at all in 7 years. So given the state of the country's finances, according to the newly elected government, it was pretty likely, wasn't it, that something like this was going to be announced?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise. Look, Rachel Reeves raised £40 billion in taxes at that last budget. So there clearly is money available. And look, there are tough decisions for the government to make. And we understand that we're not going to be at the end of every positive one. But where we are quite pleased is on that increase to the maintenance loan, because, you know, that'll make a real difference, especially when it comes to the poorer students, and is a real testament to the hard work of student campaigners over the last few years. Where we could see a real difference made would be in the reintroduction of maintenance grants. They were scrapped back in 2016 by the Conservative government, and bringing them back would give an opportunity for the government to alleviate some of those financial pressures. It's poorer students who are often more debt averse, according to research by the Sutton Trust. And I wonder if we keep increasing the fee, we will actively be deterring students from daring to enter higher education.
Who do you say should be making up the shortfall here if it isn't via students and the size of the loan?
Just 16% of funding per student is currently funded through the public purse. I believe that there should be more money coming out of the public pocket going towards universities, because I would say that what we get from universities is a public good. You get world-class research. You look at the sort of people that come out of universities, doctors, nurses, teachers, lawyers. The universities build up the backbone of our society. It's a public good and it should be funded as such.
Alex Stanley of the National Union of Students. Listening to that is Katie Normington, Vice-Chancellor of the De Montfort University in Leicester. Do you welcome today's announcement from the Education Secretary?
Well, certainly, I think, as Alex has just said, there's a real sense that higher education has been in a crisis. As you pointed out, no rise in the fees since 2017, and anyone would struggle to deliver a continued sort of service without any rise in the funding that they got. It's a kind of mixed bag. I think, as Alex points out, it passes that on to the students, although, you know, it's probably only about £30 a year over the kind of length of their debt that they would pay back. Unfortunately, of course, it comes at the same time as national insurance rises. So what we have seen in the rises, this just about now smooths out. So it's not actual, probably real money for us. But I think it opens up the debate about what the funding system should be. And the government have been quite clear that by next summer, they want to have a plan for higher education.
And when you look at that bigger picture and what the government might have in store, I know Bridget Phillipson has written to vice chancellors. Are there any indications in that letter as to what she is now thinking?
I mean, certainly the letter sets out five different factors which they'd like to see universities continue to contribute to. And those are around making sure that we are supporting disadvantaged students, ensuring there's economic growth and universities continue to support that, that we continue to play a major civic role, that we deliver high quality education, and that we undertake our own efficiencies and collaboration. And I don't think any of us would disagree with any of those. They're all very good aims to have for the universities. But I think the larger question is what will happen in the future. I don't think we probably want to see a system where the student price goes up, because I think, as Alex pointed out, it could put off particularly some disadvantaged students from going to university.
In that letter, I mean, there is criticism from the education secretaries, and they're particularly on teaching standards. She says, and I quote, there are pockets of provision where standards are unacceptably low, which means that some students are being held back by poor outcomes. Do you recognise that?
I recognise it as a statement that keeps being made. And I think one of the things you've got to do is think about how we do try to improve everything we offer. We want to make sure we're doing that. We spend every year, all of us, looking at how we can enhance the quality of what we're doing. So that is, you know, something we keep striving to. But I think also just looking at higher education across the international scene, we have one of the top five international higher education systems. So I think against that, we're providing extremely high quality.
But on international students, are you over-reliant on their fees just now?
Well, it's a mixed bag again, isn't it? Because if the home student fees isn't going to properly fund what it costs to teach a home student, then obviously universities have to diversify and find that source of income from elsewhere. And that's where we've obviously been looking in terms of international students. Universities are trying to balance their books between a number of different sources, and indeed the way in which they offer, say, commercial services to businesses as well.
OK, thank you very much for coming on, Katie Normington, Vice-Chancellor of De Montfort University in Leicester. Now to a biopic with a difference, a new film telling the story of the life of the musician Pharrell Williams, the writer and performer of one of the biggest international hits of the last 10 years, Happy, gives you a hint of what's to come in its title, Piece by Piece. Everyone who features in it is animated as a Lego model. That includes Pharrell himself, the film's director, Morgan Neville, and also at various points, Justin Timberlake, Jay-Z and Gwen Stefani. Only their voices are real. Well, Morgan Neville has been telling me how this was a story best told with Lego.
Hey, Pharrell.
Hey, how you doing, man? You know, it'd be cool as if we told my story with Lego pieces.
Lego was in the mix from the first 5 minutes of talking about this. And in a way, I don't know if this film could exist in any other form. This film, in a way, is how Pharrell thinks, which is, if I'm going to tell my story, I want to do it in a way that feels different and imaginative and true to me. And for him, that meant Lego. And for me as a filmmaker, that was the key that got me really excited about trying to figure out what that actually meant. Like, how do you make a film like this in Lego? I never thought I would be in one of my documentaries, particularly as a Lego minifig. You know, it makes complete sense once you've seen the film, but it's a bit of a crazy endeavor on the way in.
Having settled on that approach, were there any moments where you felt restricted by the medium that you had chosen to make this film out of?
Many. I mean, the thing about Lego is it's a low resolution, you know, animation form. You know, a minifig is only a couple of pieces, and a minifig has no nose, it has no ears, it can't cry or sweat, and they don't bend. And I knew there was going to be a lot of dance in this film.
I firmly believe that everybody has talent, beauty, and potential.
Keep opening our eyes to a whole different perspective.
Thank you, Mara!
We really had to think hard about how do we make this work. And in a way, I think those limitations became part of the fun of it. I mean, to the point where we even started kind of making jokes about the limitations of Lego. You know, there are no thumbs or fingers in Lego. So we started making jokes about that.
On the other side of the coin, did it enable you to do things that you wouldn't perhaps have done if it had been a more orthodox approach to a biopic?
Yeah, absolutely. You could time travel through the animation in a way that puts you in the moment when somebody's recording a song for the first time. You're there in the vocal booth with them, or you're there at the moment of creation, which is something you couldn't normally do in a documentary. But also there's something about the Lego form that I think most people have some kind of emotional connection to. I think in a way, the lack of resolution about Lego becomes something where people somehow project some of themselves into the characters. I mean, I still haven't totally figured it out, but I think people have been watching the film and feeling that the film is speaking to them in some childlike way.
On the relationship with Lego, I mean, clearly they come out of this rather nicely as well, commercially. I mean, did you have any doubts, any reservations about that aspect of making it this way?
The first meeting we had was with Lego, because if they had said no, there wouldn't have been a film. To their credit, you know, within 5 minutes, they said, we kind of love this idea. They knew that this film was going to push them in ways that were uncomfortable. I mean, we agreed up front that we weren't going to make what they say in the States is an R-rated movie, you know, an adult movie. But at the same time, we weren't going to do a G-rated movie for kids. It had to have some edge to it. And it had to explore different skin tones and hairstyles than Lego had before. And they said that was a conversation they actually were looking forward to having. And one of the great things is that Lego now is actually manufacturing new skin tones because of this film. Other than, you know, a few conversations about how you depict things like smoke in the Snoop Dogg scene, things like that, that were touchy. But once they got on board, then it was just for Pharrell then to look at my cut of the film. And I knew I wanted a film song. He watched the film and he thought about it for months. And then one day I got a text saying, here's the track. And he sent me this track, which I loved. And then a week later, he sent me a text saying, hold it, throw that track away. I have a new one. Then he sent me another track that I loved even more, which is the track that's in the film. In a way, it's a story about Pharrell, you could say, but it's also a story about a black nerd from the projects in Virginia who doesn't fit in and ultimately realizes the thing that makes him different makes him special, you know? And so it's a story about wrestling with one's own creativity.
And just a word about some of the other well-known names who appear in it.
We didn't actually tell them we were doing Lego when we did the interviews, because we were doing them remotely in the early pandemic. I revealed to everybody in the film, this is what your minifig looks like. And I will say, everybody was excited.
Woo! Holy moly, guacamole. Legendary story, yeah?
The director of Piece by Piece, Morgan Neville.
Thanks very much. The real Julian Warwicker. Well, welcome back to Solly's Grill in Milwaukee. And just before we go, we thought we'd bring you a little illustration of, a domestic illustration of political divisions in America as the clock ticks down to Election Day, because we came across a couple here. They're called Roger and Laura. They'd come from out of town. They were tucking into a butter burger lunch, and they are among the more than 75 million Americans who have already cast their ballots in early voting. They agreed to share their thoughts about the political choice facing this country.
Truthfully, for as many people as this country has, we could have done better with candidates for both sides. For me, it's the least worst.
May I ask how you voted?
I'm more on the conservative side, if that gives you any indication.
It certainly does.
Abortion's kind of a big thing for me. A life is a life. It's important.
So you're here with your wife. Does she share your opinions?
No. She just has such a bad taste with Trump. So we don't talk about it a lot.
We're not coming to ambush you. What's your name, sorry?
Laura.
Laura, nice to meet you. I'm Jamie.
Hi.
We had a nice chat to your husband.
Oh, nice.
We were talking about the election, and yes. He tells me that there are some political differences in your household.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I just think Roger's very passionate about abortion, and I get that, but I tried to tell him that one issue shouldn't be what he's basing, especially when the candidate is...
Mm-hmm. You've just done a little loop of the finger near your ear. Yes. Okay, the universal sign for a bit crazy.
Right, and I think I was successful, at least I think, converting him for this election.
Right. We've just had a chat with him. I'm not entirely sure you're right.
Right. I did not vote for Trump. I'm not impressed with him.
Are you impressed with Kamala Harris?
Yes, I really am. There's a lot of issues for women. Why are we going backwards? We need to be going forward.
Do you talk politics with your husband? Because you are coming from very different points of view.
We really don't.
But you make your marriage work. So I guess, is there a lesson in this for divided America?
I hope so.
Laura and Roger there.
Just throwing ahead, Jamie, I mean, you and I can think of enough presidential elections in the past where by the end of tomorrow, your time, a pretty clear picture would emerge. But this one doesn't feel like that, does it?
Well, it doesn't at the moment. That early voting complicates things. I mean, a lot more Americans are voting earlier. And in some states, they don't start counting those postal votes in particular until the day of the election. That is one reason why it can take time. And then, look, we have heard Donald Trump talking about a stolen election already. There's a great sense that there will be, as well, it's not unusual here in America, a lot of legal challenges at various points. But yes, it could be several days. I was here 4 years ago. It took till the Saturday for Joe Biden to be confirmed by all the news outlets here as the American president. I think there's a hope it might be slightly earlier. There might have been some learning from what happened 4 years ago. But, you know, as with the election itself, no one is very confident about the result as far as timing is concerned. Well, as far as timing is concerned, tonight, that is The World Tonight from Julian Warwick in London and me, James Kamarasamy, in Wisconsin. There will be no World Tonight tomorrow. Instead, you can tune into a special program beginning at 10, covering the US elections and those results. Roz Atkins, Nuala McGovern will be your hosts for America Decides. I'll be popping up as well. But for now, from all of us and everyone here, good night.